Your particular antenna tuner, when you adjusted it for best receiving, because you were feeding something like twin leads, do you think it had any ability to create some common mode as well as differential mode? What do you think, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the tech net?
Oh, I would imagine so, because basically as you're tuning these crazy matches, when you start getting off of 50 ohms, the common mode to differential mode is probably going all over the place. So I would imagine, yeah, that's definitely what's happening. But it was, here again, it's the dipole that's in an ugly shape that usually has that problem where you have to readjust something to get it, to make the receive match the transmit tuning, where the loop, for some reason, isn't as critical. In other words, if I take a loop and I make it an ugly shape, in other words, if I take 280 feet of random wire and just start wrapping it around, you know, going back and forth, zigzagging it, and then just terminating in a loop into, a ladder line and then feeding it back down, it seems to be much less sensitive. In other words, usually where I tune up with the antenna tuner for transmit, the receive is right on. It's usually right there. It's the dipole that generally, if you have it in an ugly shape and then you tune it for transmit and then you let go to receive, all of a sudden the receiver's dead. You'd have to basically go back and try some other position to get the receive back. Do you understand now, Dick?
Yes, I do. And I'm going to be passing it back to Mel to give us a couple of words on what he saw with common mode, which differential mode. And I'm going to give a couple of words of explanation. If I was putting 100 watts into 300 ohm twin lead, that 100 watts on the 300 ohm twin lead, if it really was loaded with 300 ohms, would be 173 volts I'm launching into that wire. Let me round off the numbers. Let's assume it was 200 volts, and maybe that comes out 130 watts. So I'm creating a 200 volt RMS signal into my twin lead. If I'm feeding the twin lead in a thoroughly differential manner, at one instant of time, I'm putting plus 100 volts on the right-hand wire and minus 100 volts on the left-hand wire. I've got 200 volts of differential between the two, and a half cycle later, those voltages are both polarity reversed. That's full differential mode. If I fed the twin lead in a common mode manner, I might be putting plus 100 volts on the right-hand wire and plus 100 volts on the left-hand wire simultaneously. That's common mode feeding. When you do that, many antennas, particularly a loop, and to some degree a dipole, let me drop, will shift in their polarization characteristics. So even though you think that dipole is purely horizontal, you think that loop antenna is purely horizontal, when you start feeding common mode voltages in there, because your antenna tuner has enough knobs and will let you do that, all of a sudden the antenna becomes a lot more vertically polarization sensitive rather than purely horizontally polarization sensitive. Bell has done some experimenting with that, found some huge advantages that when he starts telling people on the air what he's doing, they don't believe it. It's just too good to be true. And so once you've got the right kind of an antenna tuner, the right kind of a feed line, and the ability to understand some of this, in the shack, you've got a tremendous amount of adaptability of that antenna, even though you installed it once in that crawl space, and it's a less than ideal antenna. Then the only thing that really affects how well you transmit or receive, once you've got this adaptability, is what are the local blockages of the building, the absorption of the materials of your building, and how high it is above the ground. And those things within that crawl space you don't have control over per se. So I'll bet you've gotten a lot of skepticism when you told the guys you were talking to what you were doing with your loop antenna with that exotic antenna tuner of yours now. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net.
This is K2KEY. All right, let me just finalize this because it's after 10 with this young gentleman by the name of Jimmy. And Jimmy put a dipole up. If you can stretch out the dipole, a 40-meter dipole, cut it to the formula, stretch it out, use that auto-tuner that you have with the ICOM 7000, and I think you will be able to get on HF. And be patient. It may take a little doing to make contacts and all, but the bottom line is give it a try. This way you won't have to be diddling around going back and forth. You can pre-cut the wire and everything take it up with you. And you said you want the feed points going to come out right in your closet, right through the ceiling of the little hole in the closet in your bedroom. So it's ideal to do it that way, as you more or less laid out in your email to me. So I think you keep in touch and all, but we all agree basically the bang for the buck is a simple doublet. Okay, let me let it drop and then I'll say a few words about who. Okay, now as far as a full wave loop, which I have out here, 275 feet of wire, there were a serious group that were on 75 meters that were very devoted to putting up loop antennas and doing experiments. It was outlined a number of times in magazines by QSD about different loops, tilting them, and doing all kinds of oddities. What I have found, according to like Glenn had just made mention of, that there is a strange phenomenon that does sometimes be very prominent on these loops. And I thought at first maybe it was my tuner happened to be using a Johnson kilowatt matchbox with a link coupling. Let me let it drop. It uses link coupling. I'm using balanced feed into it. In other words, the loop is actually one continuous wire that goes up from the shack to an insulator, goes around 275 feet, returns to that insulator, then comes down back to the shack. So it's one continuous piece of wire. Now, what happens is I was doing experiments with it, and I have a current meter in each one of these lines, open line feeders. And I thought, oh boy, when I get this, you know, the adjustment on the tuner with equal currents going into both of the lines, oh boy, this should be, seems to be right. Figure to the SWR, everything looks good on the meter, on the tuner and all. Great. Yet, let me let it drop one more time. The report came back that when I swung that tuning system slightly so that one meter on the current meter, reading the current in the line, was higher than the other one, I got better reports. Signal stronger, definitely. Read it many times, that experiment. And in fact, there was an article that was followed up by one of the guys that was involved also with the loopers, came up with a fairly exotic tuner for loops using two rotary inductors and butterfly capacitors, something completely different from what we've ever seen the way of tuners laid out using two rotary inductors. The loop does do a little different than you know, than we've been used to seeing happen in more normal use of say dipoles. Dick, over.
I accept that. You're putting up a lot more area of wire when you're putting up a loop, 270 feet of wire on 80 meters, as opposed to 132 feet as a simple dipole. And you're going to get some more performance if you got the right amount of adaptability. But at first, I don't think your writer has to do all that. And the antenna doesn't have to be 100% successful the very first time. I'm not talking about going back into the crawl space and changing it. I'm just talking about all the changes that could be done in the shack, changing the feed line length, changing the way the antenna tuner works, the way the transmitter works, and so on, at different grounding systems and differential mode versus common mode to control polarization. A lot of experiments can be done. Every one of us as a beginning amateur scans all of the manuals, all of the catalog, and we try to find out which transmitter is the best, which receiver is the best, which antenna is the best, and whatever. In reality, optimizing the equation sounds very logical in the beginning. Let me drop. And the bottom line is, the very first time you set up a ham station, it doesn't have to be perfect. Going to a flea market or to eBay and buying used equipment at one-third or one-quarter the price, as long as you've chosen a brand name and a model number that's got a good reputation, and even if the rig has got a dented front panel, as long as most of the electronics is there, there are people in this club like Andy, WA2CDL, that can fix anything. If that rig was ever on the air in the past, he can get it on the air again in the future. So that's the That's not a variable, so to speak, as long as you're not buying an empty box. And there's ways you can be sort of sure about that. But the number of people being stuck when they buy something used or over eBay is very small. We're hearing very few bad reports along those lines. So the first rig doesn't have to be ideal. The first antenna and the way you feed it and whatever doesn't have to be ideal. Get on the air, start talking to people, and then have the pleasure of making the modifications to improve the performance. That's my suggestion. Don't have to worry so much. The first crack out of the bag doesn't have to be perfect. The next guy who signed in was, I'm not sure if it's Julius or Jay, KC2YSK, a man who lives in Huntington. That's a good town. And Jay or Julius, if you're there, go right ahead with your question or comment. KC2YSK, K2RIW in the tech net. My name is Dick.
Question on that topic, Dick, WS2N.
Let me first make sure that Jay is there. Jay, are you there? I was a little bit afraid of that. We've kept him waiting a couple of hours. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, you talked about the common mode and the differential mode. When I transmit on HF, I have a dipole, a couple of dipoles. So I always assume it's differential. One side's positive, the other one's negative. And then you talk about the common mode. I mean, how do I do that? I mean, there's no switch on my HF rig to say, okay, I want the common mode. How do I get one side positive and the other side positive at the same time to change my dipole from vertical to, you know, from a horizontal to, you know, changing polarization to vertical? I mean, I don't have a loop, but, you know, in other words, could you do this with a dipole? You know, how do you go about doing this? Switching between the two. I'm not familiar with this thing.
It's a darn good question, Paul. If I had a very simple system with nothing but a SO239 connector on the back of the rig going into a piece of coaxial cable that goes up to the dipole with or without a ballon at the dipole, in that circumstance, no, you cannot do it. If in turn you're taking the coaxial cable coming out of the back of the rig going into an antenna tuner, and if the properly designed antenna tuner is then feeding twin lead is the best, although it could be done with coax, but the right kind of an antenna tuner is now capable of creating the common mode. I will admit that when you create the common mode for the first time in your life, the way you ground the antenna tuner does become important RF-wise. Because when you're feeding common mode voltage, just like Arnold Schwarzenegger floating in the cargo hold of the space shuttle, and he's a 200-pound man, and he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand. He pushes the barbell 1 meter per second to the north. His body is going to move 1 meter per second to the south. Action and reaction. You got to push against something. When you're launching common mode voltage into a so-called twin lead transmission line, you're launching those voltages with reference to ground. So there's a third lead coming out of the back end of that adaptive antenna tuner, which has got a real ground lead going to something that's really grounded in your environment. It may be the copper water pipes of your house. It may be a nice fat piece of wire going out to a grounding rod outside the window of your shack, if you know what I mean. So it takes another adaptive piece of equipment, like an antenna tuner, that's set up to normally twist, transmit into twin lead to do this. And of the ones you can buy, can they do that? I suspect very few of them. Although with a fairly minor modification.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
With a fairly minor modification, you can create this capability in the antenna tuner. Wonder if that makes a little bit more sense, Paul. Your main motivation for doing this is that now you're creating a brand new polarization of your antenna. You may think that horizontal dipole out there is a purely horizontally polarized antenna. You feed it common mode voltage on its twin lead, it starts becoming a hell of a lot more vertically polarized on its reception and transmission. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I could see a purpose for it, so that's why I was thinking about it. In other words, if you you're a station in Massachusetts somewhere and you want to work them, work a, maybe the ground wave, you know, it would be, you know, he's got a vertical antenna, I've got a dipole or a loop that's horizontally polarized. Boy, I would love to, you know, hit a button and say, okay, now it's vertically polarized. Now I can work the guy. That's the first thought that crossed my mind when you were talking about this. How could you do this? But okay, it's almost like taking the semiconductor and the shield and pushing the positive out on that and having the having a negative component involved, you know, for the
N-Y-2,
for the RF ground, but somehow done through the antenna tuner system. Okay, I'm out though. That's yeah, I've got coax and I've got an internal antenna tuner, but nice to know it's doable. Back to you, Dick.
Lou recognized, going to get you in the center in a second. One of the things that's not made clear in all of the books that we read, antenna manual among others, is that every single HF signal you and I have ever listened to has experienced some amount of Faraday polarization rotation when it went through that ionosphere. And whether it shifted by 45 degrees or 450 degrees, that's the only one to argue about. It is shifting in polarization. We have all experienced QSB on reception of an HF signal. The signal is going up and down in amplitude. We think when it goes down in amplitude that the signal is either not getting here or it is skipping over us. A certain significant percentage of the time when that signal goes into a fade, it is faded because the signal went to a polarization that's at right angles to your antenna. Your antenna may be set up for horizontal, and during that period of time, the signal arrived vertical. None of the books make that clear. So polarization rotation is going on all the time. And if you've got adaptability in polarization, you're going to be way ahead of the game. And Mother Nature's ionosphere and the strength of the magnetic field is always changing. And the propagation itself, because of a change in meteorology as well as ionosphere and Earth's magnetic field and the coronal mass expulsions from the sun, all of this jazz is changing so that that signal is never a steady state. It's always moving in the way it bounces, the angles at which it bounces, the magnitude of the amount of bounce, the polarization, and so on. So as we get smarter and build our antennas in a more adaptive manner, an awful lot of these variabilities are going to go away. That's a bunch of opinions. And Mel has done a bunch of experiments that are strong confirmation of those opinions.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Lou, what do you got to add to all this? NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, 1 second. Is a long wire considered common mode because it's only going up one end and you've got your ground as a counterpoint?
Yeah, Don, good point. In the case of an end-fed ZEP antenna, a long wire, you're never feeding that antenna anything but common mode. You don't have a differential mode in that particular antenna. You can't do it there. So it's got to be a quasi-center-fed antenna to really experience this. Good point. When you've only got one wire, there's only one way you can feed it. Great, you brought that to our attention, Paul. Lou, go right ahead. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
D2WGB, just add me to the list, please. Then.
You're on it, John. Go ahead, Lou.
Okay, very point. So, in common mode, one point is that the feed line itself is part of the, it radiates. So, if you think of that, you can see that the radiation is emitting from dimensionally different condition than it is fully differential. And Mel, I guess, could go anywhere in between the two, so that's great. So the comment I had was on, you had asked Glenn what an advantage might be to a horizontal antenna as opposed to, say, a dipole. Dick, why don't you address the impedance at certain harmonics? It was my understanding that odd harmonics, the impedance would be low on a dipole, but the even harmonics, it would be high, but on a loop, it is low on both the even and the odd harmonics. Go ahead.
I'm a bit skeptical of that. The best experiment we've got along these lines is what Rich N2EO was doing a couple of years ago. He had an 80-meter dipole, which in the beginning he was feeding with coax. It worked very poorly on 40 meters. He eventually fed it with twin lead, and on 40 meters it worked like a charm. An 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long wire, fed in the center with twin lead, is approximately a 72 ohm antenna at 80 meters where you've tuned it. When you go to, that's where it's a half wave long. When you go to the frequency where it is a full wave long, 40 meters, the center impedance, instead of being 72 ohms, is probably something like 3,000 ohms. So therefore, you would have a 60 to 1 standing wave ratio if you fed it with 50 ohm twin lead, if there was such a thing. You're probably going to end up with a little bit lower than that when you feed it with 300 ohm twin lead, but you can still see it's a huge standing wave ratio, a lot of mismatch. And if you got an antenna tuner with enough range and twin lead and transmission line, open wire line that's low enough and long, the fact that the transmission line is running at a very high standing wave ratio almost doesn't matter if it's low enough loss material. Coax is not very forgiving along these lines. So most dipole-like antennas fed in the center, let me drop, have a nice controlled resistive impedance at the half wave point. And all the odd number of half waves, they come close to doing that again. If I fed that 80-meter dipole at the third harmonic frequency, which would be what? Around 10 megacycles, it would come back into a kind of resistive resonance again. It might not be 72 ohms, maybe it would be 93 ohms, but you can see on the odd number of half wavelengths, you hit resistive resonance. On the even number of half wavelengths, you're feeding essentially an open circuit, very close to an open circuit. It's the equivalent of feeding a dipole instead of the center. You can feed the dipole out at one end if you want to, but you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance when you do that instead of a 70 ohm impedance. With the right kind of a balun and impedance matching device, it'll give you full performance feeding it at one end. So a half-wave dipole, one continuous piece of wire without a center insulator, 132 feet long, and you feed it at the outer end, and you get the right kind of impedance match that can feed a 1,500 ohm resistor. Maybe it's 2,000 ohms, but it's in that neighborhood. It'll work like a charm. So there's nothing magic about feeding in the center. You can feed a dipole the center, 10% away from the center, halfway from the center to the tip, like a Windham antenna, so to speak. As long as you get the right kind of balun and impedance match, as long as the energy gets to the antenna and the antenna is a resonant structure, everything works like a charm. Even if the antenna is not a resonant structure, you can force it into resonance with the antenna tuner if you've got low enough feed line and the right kind of a balancing structure. So maybe this is some of the answer you're looking for, but let me drop one more time. You and others are absolutely right when you talk about the fact that when you start feeding common mode into the transmission line, what you think is an antenna is starting to become a top hat capacitor, and the transmission line itself is doing a substantial amount of the radiation. There are pros and cons to that. The fact that you're now getting vertical polarization reception of a signal that arrived at your QTH vertically polarized, huge advantage. If that transmission line happens to run alongside of your neighbor's apartment and it runs close to his television set, that common mode radiation of the transmission line directly into his television set could give him some grief. So it's not a perfect solution. For people with a private home, that's usually not much of a problem. So maybe that's some of the information you're looking for, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very fine. So a loop would then, on even harmonics, have probably a lower impedance than a dipole. So I don't know if that's an advantage or not in terms of matching, but it's something that they tout on certain areas that I read. But okay, very fine. Move on. Thank you. Then why do
I? Yeah, you brought up a good point. I didn't really discuss the same thing with a loop. In the case of a dipole the first resonant point is where the dipole center fed is half-wave long. In the case of a loop, it's when the total circumference of the loop is one wavelength. That's the first primary resonance. And now, if you feed the loop at twice the frequency, where the loop is on its second harmonic, it'll come back to resonance again. However, halfway in between, when you're 1.5 times the frequency, the loop could give you an extremely high impedance. Every antenna, when you plot its impedance in a continuous manner as you slide the frequency, it's going to go through some great big peaks and valleys of resistance and reactance. Every antenna does that. When you start off an antenna that has one full wavelength of circumference to begin with, then on the harmonically related ham band, it does look like it falls into a friendlier relationship. That doesn't stop you from using half-wave dipoles on these crazy harmonics. It just forces you into having greater tuning range of the antenna tuner. And you've made the investment with that loop by putting out a lot more wire. 270 feet of wire is a pretty substantial installation for many of us. The next person who signed in was Ray, KC2YRO, and I know that John wants to be on the list. He's going to be right after Ray. Ray, if you're still there, go right ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay. We've been so long on the previous subject, we put these guys to sleep. John, you've got it. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. My question is on a spectrum analyzer. I have two identical spectrum analyzers, and what I want to do is lock the tracking generators together. If I take the 10 megahertz output from one into a Y connection, plug it into both of the internal reference, will that lock up the tracking generators? That's my question.
Okay. In the case of a tracking generator, which usually is something built into or designed to be attached to the various input and output connectors on the back panel of a spectrum analyzer, a tracking generator, the main thing you want it to do is to literally track hertz for hertz. In other words, when the spectrum analyzer is scanning across, let me pick a number, 100 to 200 megacycles, at the instant it scans through 144 megacycles, you want the tracking generator at that instant time to be putting out 144 megacycles, plus and minus nothing if you can get it. And that way the tracking generator, which usually is looking at the exact same sweeping oscillator, your spectrum analyzer has a sweeping oscillator. And so that sweeping oscillator that's sweeping the reception of the spectrum analyzer is the exact same oscillator that you want to be sweeping the transmission characteristics of your tracking generator. It usually is the exact same sweeping oscillator used in both cases. Now when it comes to the reference oscillator in the spectrum analyzer, the main thing that reference oscillator does is say that when you scan the analyzer into the so-called zero scan mode, and I set it for 144.000 megacycles. Once that oscillator is set, that reference oscillator is set correctly, the readout of the spectrum analyzer will be very close to reality as if it was a frequency counter. That's the main thing you're doing. So now if I've got two completely separate machines, let me drop. One is a swept signal generator, not necessarily designed to be married to this particular spectrum analyzer. And I've got a thoroughly separate spectrum analyzer. And they both just happen to have a 10 megacycle reference. And you force those two references to be the same. And when you adjust the spectrum analyzer in the zero scan mode for 144.0, and in the zero scan mode you adjust the sweeping signal generator for 144.0, yeah, they're going to agree. But now when you set them sweeping, are they really sweeping at the exact same rate? Are they really starting each sweep at the exact same period of time? And throughout the sweep, are they sweeping with the exact same waveform so that they stay tracked to each other? The way a tracking generator does that is it says the one thing that's really in common is the sweeping oscillator, the voltage-controlled oscillator. Often it is a Yig-tuned oscillator. If you take the signal directly out of the Yig-tuned oscillator, and some of it goes to the spectrum analyzer frequency scanning function, and some of it goes to your tracking generator, now, by definition, you have forced them to be synchronized in time, synchronized in frequency, and you get beautiful operation. I think you can see some of the errors that can occur if you've got two thoroughly separate instruments that were not designed to be married together. You can make it happen, but you're going to have to work a little harder, is my first guess on that one, John. Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, he's got the tracking generator built into his 3585 HP.
Okay, if the tracking generator is already built into the spectrum analyzer, then there is no problem, and you don't have to force the references to be the same, I don't think. But maybe I've misunderstood the question. Back to you, John.
Yes, I have two identical units, and I was looking to lock them together with causing the tracking generators to perform exactly the same, and I was thinking of doing it with, say, A and B, take A, split that in two, use that as the reference input for the first one, and the second one, to allow the tracking generator to come on at the same time. That was really what I wanted to do.
Okay. Now, hold on, Eric. You used an ambiguous set of words there, John. I've got two identical units. Are they two identical spectrum analyzers? Are they two identical sweeping signal generators? Are they one of each? Just making the reference oscillator the same might not be enough. What is forcing them to start the sweep at the exact same instant? What's forcing them to start at the exact same frequency before they sweep? What's forcing them to sweep with the exact same waveform during the sweep? Over to you, John.
Okay, they're two identical spectrum analyzers, and I was just looking to lock up the clock so they both have the same reference oscillator. That's what I was attempting to do. Does that make it a little clearer?
Okay, I think you want them both to read a signal and indicate the exact same frequency of that signal. I thought you were setting up a sweeping signal generator setup. Maybe I misunderstood. Back to you, John.
No, I'm not setting up a sweeping signal generator. I'm going to use the spectrum analyzers with two different amplifiers that I'm looking at, but and they're going to go into the two separate analyzers, but I wanted the tracking signal to be identically matched with it. That was what I was trying to do by inserting the same clock in both of them.
Okay, a third set of words have just been presented to us, John. You've now got two tracking, you believe, spectrum analyzers being fed from two separate amplifiers, being fed by a third instrument, a tracking signal generator. That's what I think I just heard. Now back to you, John.
No, I'm confusing you, Dick. All right, two spectrum analyzers, A and B, that's all. Two little amplifiers that are being analyzed by the spectrum analyzers. But I'm just looking to lock up the tracking generator. There's one in each. They're both the identical units. And I was going to use the one clock signal to lock up both in time. Does that make it a little clearer?
Okay, now there are four instruments, two spectrum analyzers and two tracking signal generators. Eric, KE2EJ, straighten me out here. K2RIW in the segment.
The only way that's going to happen, and I've used laboratory instruments that will let you do that, where you actually get an external signal input to trigger when the sweep occurs, and then the actual VCO waveform output can be fed from one spectrum analyzer to the other. If you don't have those inputs and outputs, it ain't never going to happen.
Yeah, I think I agree with what Eric just said. If the voltage-controlled oscillator that is really doing the sweeping of the signal generator is not the exact same signal by way of BNC connectors on the back panel, that's doing the sweeping of the spectrum analyzer. The sweeping of the analyzer or analyzers and the sweeping of the tracking generator must be fed by the exact same voltage-controlled sweeping oscillator in order to truly force tracking. That's real tracking. Now, can you do a poor man's equivalent of that by having them start at the exact same frequency with a synchronization signal and they sweep at the exact same rate and you adjust the knobs accordingly to force it into tracking? You can do that, but it's a lot more difficult if they're not truly sharing the exact same sweeping voltage-controlled oscillator. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, so if I do lock the two of them together and use an external trigger that's equal for both of them, then the system should work. Does that sound logical?
You're halfway there. If they got the exact same 10 meg reference oscillator, in theory that means they both start at the same frequency. But most spectrum analyzers and most sweeping signal generators do not precisely measure the frequency being generated during the sweep. So, during the sweep, one could sweep faster than the other and go out of track. One could sweep with a slightly different waveform than the other and go out of track. Even though they start at the exact same frequency, and because of external triggering, they're starting their sweep at the exact same instant of time. They may not stay tracked across the screen if they are independent sweeping oscillators. Now, you and I could, with a whole lot of computer software, do what's called a lock and roll circuit. In other words, we could make a more elaborate sweeping oscillator, which is counting the frequency as it sweeps, and some kind of a comparison circuit is comparing the count of sweeping oscillator 1 and sweeping oscillator 2 and keeping those counts tracking to each other. We could force that, but that's not the usual way. So locking the reference oscillators is the first step. Locking the timing of start by synchronization is the next step. But what is going to force them to sweep the exact same rate during the sweep at the exact same waveform during the sweep? Over to you, John, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you. I understand the difficulty now. It's going to be in the individual sweep time of the units, which could be slightly different, even though they're triggered and they're working on the same oscillator. All right, that answers my question. Thank you for taking it, and back to the net.
Sweep time is the third ingredient required. Sweep waveform and linearity of sweep is the fourth ingredient. Your particular swept spectrum analyzer, when it's sweeping from 100 megs to 200 megs, left side of the screen to the right side of the screen, because you've commanded it to do that, you assume in the center of the screen it hit exactly 150.00 megacycles. Sweeping oscillator A may be a little bit above that. Sweeping oscillator B may be a little bit below that. It could even start and stop at the exact same frequency, start and stop at the exact same time, because you carefully adjusted the vernier knobs, but still go out of track in the middle of the band because one is sweeping with a sawtooth waveform that bows upward a little bit and the other one bows downward a little bit. You're going to get some of that effect. All we have to discuss is how much. If you're sweeping with a resolution bandwidth of 3 megacycles, you'll never see it. If you're sweeping with a resolution bandwidth of 1 kilohertz, I don't think you're going to get there. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick. That does it for me. Perfect. I've got enough information to continue with what I have to do, and I thank you very kindly. Back to the net.
Yeah, Eric may have a couple of words he wants to add to this. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now you basically got it right. Even though they're the same devices, the linearity of the sweep. You know, one thing that you could do is, these days, spectrum analyzers don't let you uncalibrate the sweep, so to speak. But one of the things you could do is trigger them together and use a single tracking generator output and it will, even though there may be some linearity differences, but you'll still see the end result in terms of the sweep on both of them. So you could run the experiment of triggering them so that their sweep time starts at the same time. By the way, if you're working from a 10 megahertz reference, I do believe in a modern spectrum analyzer, the actual reference frequency will be divided from the reference oscillator. So chances are you'll get both the same starting frequency. But the linearity of the tracking generator is where you may have the problem. But at least with the receiver part of the spectrum analyzer, you're still going to see that RF information, even though it may not be exactly on the same side of both screens at the same time.
Yeah, the whole reason why you use a tracking signal generator is because you're aligning the flatness of something, an amplifier, a filter, or whatever. As the tracking deviates, because you want to look at the fine details and you're using a 1 kilohertz resolution bandwidth on the spectrum analyzer, and the tracking signal generator is a little bit different in its sweeping linearity, so during a portion of the sweep, it's right in the center of the filter of the spectrum analyzer, another portion of the sweep is on the right-hand skirt, another portion is on the left-hand skirt, you can get some mysterious wiggles of the apparent flatness of the device that you're aligning, and what you're really seeing is funniness of the spectrum analyzer, sweeping generator, tracking phenomena. Now, by way of putting in a bypass circuit, a piece of coaxial cable instead of the amplifier or a filter that you're aligning, you can rapidly get a clue as to whether or not your tracking is good enough before you put in the device on the test. So there's ways you can check on this. And maybe I'm worrying unnecessarily, but if your resolution bandwidth of the receiving device is wide enough, some of these problems go away. If I'm using a 3 megacycle wide resolution bandwidth on the spectrum analyzer, and the tracking linearity is deviating plus or minus 20 kilohertz out of a 3 megacycle resolution bandwidth, you'll never see it. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this one? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, of all the people who have listened, signed in, or whatever, and you're still awake, and you're with us, have we skipped over anyone before we go back to some of our deeper subjects that we started off with earlier? Have we skipped over anyone? Give me your call. Oh, wait a minute now. Sorry. Paul, you're about to give us a space report. And what is the latest on that ammonia pump that had to be replaced in space so that cooling, full cooling capacity can be restored on the International Space Station? Where do we stand on that one? I wasn't smart enough to look during the week. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N. Yeah, last week we left off with the spacewalk. It was not 100% successful. The idea was to do this all in 2 spacewalks. One to go out, remove that failed ammonia pump, this 800-pound thing, maybe 5 feet wide by 3 feet high by maybe 4 feet deep. This ammonia pump, there's 2 of them attached to the space station. There's a port side and a starboard side. The starboard side that had failed. The idea was to remove this, put it in onto the mobile tracking unit. It's like train-like device that runs the length of the space station. And to go get another one, they have spares, and then there's 4 spares up there, and to install that, let me drop it. Well, the 2 spacewalkers did go out there, and they had problems with the one line that they couldn't disconnect. There's 5 electrical connections to disconnect. 4 of these ammonia connections to disconnect, and they had Tracy Dyson out there, female, and they had her partner was was involved with the Doug Wheelock, and they're doing all three spacewalks to do this. Now, you got to remember, the shuttle's not attached. There are six people on board, and they needed to successfully disconnect four of these ammonia lines. Each ammonia line is an inch and a half in diameter. It doesn't look like that when you're looking on the when you look at the pictures, but each one is an inch and a half in diameter. And they have these shut-off valves, the quick disconnect type of valve. The idea is to shut the valve off and then push a button to disconnect each connection that's now attached to a flex line. And then they, in turn, hook them up to a jumper box to retain the pressure within the line. Three went good. The first one that they were trying didn't go good, so they went back after an 8-hour spacewalk, and then they tried again to drop it. Last, I believe it was Wednesday, and it went well. I mean, they went out there, Wheelock successfully cycled the valve, which means turn it on and off, and disconnected it. And then they had a couple of four bolts to disconnect this thing. And then remove it and stow it on this mobile transport unit. So it did take two spacewalks to do that. And now there's an additional spacewalk tomorrow. But the same two will go out and disconnect the new ammonia pumping system from right near the Quest module. That's the module where they exit the space station all the time. That's the American version. That has an airlock system in there. In fact, they sleep in there overnight when they go to a spacewalk to purge all the nitrogen out of their body. So it's like a room, this Quest lab. And then the next day they go out and they do the spacewalk. Well, right near that is where these pumps are stored to get new ones. So they'll go out there tomorrow, disconnect that, and reinstall that into the S1 truss segment. S1, there's 11 of these truss segments that makes up the length of this whole space station, roughly the length of a football field. So it's the one nearest the, they go out, there's the S1, S3, S4, all the way out to S5 and 6. That's your starboard side, and then you have the P's, the P, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, going out the other way.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Time out, but they'll go out and reinstall that, and we'll see how that goes. Reconnecting four ammonia lines, five electrical cables, and of course bolting the thing now with that four bolts to the S1 structure, and then slowly bringing everything back online. They expect it to take about a day or so, maybe up until Thursday before they have the cooling properly going. Everything's redundancy on this thing, so it pretty much knocked off the a lot of the equipment from the Columbus module, that's the European Space Station module, and the Kaibo module, which is the Japanese module, and these are some of the modules that are being supplied by this cooling system. And, they've had them running. They didn't lose any science. They had some kind of jumper system involved to keep them running. But they'll bring everything back up to normal probably by Thursday. So that's going well. It looks good. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. So that was the update I wanted to give you on the ISS ammonia pumping system. And one other update I wanted to give you is on Spirit and Opportunity. The rover is driving around on Mars. Spirit has been inoperative for many, many months. They're into the middle of the winter on Mars. They haven't heard a signal from it
many, many months. Opportunity is doing very well, but the Spirit has got its problems. It got bogged down there, probably 6 months ago. Been trying to get it out. It's not going anywhere. For now, when the time came, and they wanted to get this Spirit on an angle. They've done this on the other winters that they've gone through, where the panels face the sun, and they couldn't do it this time around. So this is the first time they think that could be a loss, a problem with maybe not getting Spirit back to normal, unfortunately. What happens is it's getting very cold up there. It's going to get down to minus 60 when we drop it. Instead of maybe minus 40 that they've had in the past. And they use the whatever sunlight they do get onto the panels during the winter. They kind of go into a sleep mode. They don't do any science. They use all their energy to try to keep their batteries warm, to keep the circuits warm inside. They've sent, they've been waiting for signals to come back. They sent commands up, trying to get the spacecraft to respond, but no go. And they might wait all the way until November now before they might hear a signal. What happens is the power gets so low, and they think it could be getting low enough where the clock on board stops running. And once that happens, it's pretty much dead in the water. It does have a backup system if that does happen. What will happen then is after November, if the clock is stopped, Spirit will, and it does get a little bit more sunlight as the Martian winter goes away. Starts to come back to life. If the clock isn't on board, it won't be able to receive signals or send signals. So it's got a backup program in it every hour, during daylight only, it's roughly 24 hours on Mars, similar to Earth, a little longer on Mars, but during the daylight, every hour on the hour, or at the top of its hour, what it thinks it would be the top of the hour, it'll come on for about 20 minutes. Looking for signals on Earth and sending a signal back. And if that does happen in November, what will happen is Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, that's where this all is operated out of, drop it, will then send another program up there to bring it back to life, to let it know what time of day it is, what it has to do, and maybe they'll be able to bring it back to the way it was before this all happened, and then go back to trying to get it out of the sand that the one wheel has dug itself into, over the top of the wheel. So, but I don't know, if you read the articles, it looks like it could be as a Spirit, but they're waiting for a miracle is the way it's written. But Opportunity Zone's good. A couple of windstorms came by, blew the dust off of it. That just happened many, many times in the past. And when that happens, it gets better sunlight, and the panels charge. And in fact, they just recently gained about 10-20% more power than they were getting with one windstorm that went by. And they did their... With Opportunity, they finally photographed some dust devils over there. They saw plenty of it with Spirit, but none with Opportunity. And it's the first time they have seen one come by for Opportunity. So that's the latest on the ISS then, and the Mars landers. One more lander to come, not too far away there.
In the last week report you gave us, Paul, when it comes to the replacement of the failed ammonia pump that's part of the cooling system, one of those connectors, when they open up that particular cable going into the pump, there's a self-sealing valve that was not sealing and ammonia was leaking out, and therefore they reconnected that connector so as not to lose the ammonia. What did they do to stop that from happening, Paul? How did they get a chance to fully remove the old ammonia pump when one of those connectors wasn't properly self-sealing? Back to you, Mel. I mean, Paul.
Yeah, that's what I mean by recycling the valves. If you do that, you know, recycling basically means you're opening and closing valves. And they tried to do that on a failed attempt, and because of the pressure that had built up, and they were waiting to go into a nighttime cycle, maybe it'll cool down, whatever ammonia was in that line was building up pressure, and they were unable to do it. Before they went out this time, they essentially run the pump to create a vacuum. They're able to pull the vacuum on these lines. So I guess they must have successfully did that with it, now there was nothing in there. But the reason it was happening was because when they were closing the valves, and the valves were leaking, and more ammonia was leaking into the lines, creating pressure. That was creating a problem. But by cycling the valves this time, they successfully, essentially, it's almost like a dirty valve. Well, in this case, probably ammonia rice being caught in the gate part of the valve, not closing all the way. I mean, probably minuscule. You got to remember these things are under high pressure. It's not like a regular air conditioning system. You do have a high side and low side, but on an air conditioning, you have a high side, which is gas, and low side, which is in the liquid form. Here, it's all liquid ammonia, but the high side is 300 psi, 500 psi, the low side is 300 psi. So something must be getting past these valves to create that problem, but at this time, they didn't have that. It worked out okay. So, that's the story on that.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Spirit and opportunity. It sounds like Spirit has almost lost its spirit. I'm guessing that one is in the northern hemisphere of Mars and the other's in the southern hemisphere. That's why one's in summer and the other's in winter. Which one is which, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, they're both roughly near the equator. I mean, they're pretty close. I think they're only like 20 degrees north or south. And Spirit right now is in the winter time, so that puts it in the northern hemisphere. So, but all your other spacecraft are really doing well. You know, I mean, Mars, Global Surveyor, that one quit working a couple of years ago. That started around, I think, the mid-90s. But that thing finally quit working. That did a lot of good science. That let them know where to send, really, these two spacecraft. They saw that hematite on a surface, and that's these little round balls. That's what they call a hematite. And then they know these things are only formed from where water was, and that was from the spectrum analyzing of that spacecraft in orbit. They get that information. So that thing did well, but that finally quit working. You've got the European Space Agency, Mars Express up there doing well. That's doing well also. Equatorial in orbit. You've got the let me think now. I think that's polar orbit. The Mars Odyssey, I believe it's equatorial. That's the American spacecraft. And then you've got Mars, Reconnaissance Orbiter, I think it is. They call it Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's a big one. That's still doing very well. That's the one that took pictures. Let me drop it. That one's got really good cameras on board. That took pictures, live pictures of